from Richmond.
Hi, I'm Deanna, an alcoholic.
Hi,
Thanks for
Deanna.
having me today. I was planning on coming in person, but the weather had other ideas. So now I'm coming to you from my very cold home. So I'll just dive right in. So my sobriety date is 9/119. That is not my first sobriety date. God willing, it's my last. I am. Let's see, I guess I'll just start at the beginning. I grew up in Detroit. I guess I started out with, just as a kid, I felt really isolated, alone, different, I guess. I didn't know that I felt different. I just knew that I didn't feel comfortable. I didn't feel like I could be open with people. I didn't feel like I could that I could re they could relate to me. I was afraid that they were going to be able that they wouldn't understand me. I don't know if I ever tried, but it just was this I was just this awkward kid that spent a lot of time alone, and I didn't know that it was there was anything going on until I had my first drink. And I had my first drink when I was 12. It was at my dad's wedding to my best friend's mom. And it was very, casual, just family in the basement, in Detroit, that's what we do, every party's in the basement. And so we just had my dad's side of the family and my best friend's, mom's her side of the family. I knew everybody there. She had been my friend for years, and so I knew everybody, and we're in the basement. People were dancing. My uncle, my dad's younger brother, comes up and says, "Here, try this," and he hands me a Fuzzy Navel, and I was like, "Okay," and I liked it. It's sweet, and then all of a sudden, I felt different. And I don't, I just, there's only certain things like there's a lot of things I don't remember that have happened to me in my life. I'm 56 years old. There's a lot of things I don't remember, but I could tell you what I was wearing, where I was standing, who was standing in front of me, what that tasted like, and what it felt like. It changed my life. I was relaxed. Suddenly, this invisible wall that I didn't really know was there disappeared, and I felt like I belonged. I felt like I was one of you. I felt like I could just be myself, and I wasn't different. That you weren't going to laugh at me. That self-consciousness all went away. I danced, and I think I danced one dance, and then I went back over to that little card table where we had all the alcohol, and that's where I stood the rest of the night drinking. I drank as much as I could get that whole night. I didn't go out on the dance floor anymore. I just drank. And the next thing I remember, the next thing I do remember is I was taking a little break on the stairs. And someone said to me, "That's not right, like a good place to take a nap on the stairs to the basement." And then I don't remember a lot of things, but the next morning I remember waking up and immediately just bursting into tears because I knew I had ruined the evening. I had done things, it was a little fuzzy, but I had done things that I wouldn't talk about until I did my first fifth step. I was 12. I drank so much and I got so sick. So my first drink, I ended up drunk, blacking out, getting sick, and doing things that I would never want to share with anyone. I was going to take to my grave. And I swore I would never do that again. I was like, I'll never drink again. That's just not going to happen. Being 12, that seemed kind of easy, right? Okay, I just won't do that anymore. You would think it would be easy. A month later, I'm at my mom's wedding to my dad's best friend. I won't go into that story. But so I'm at this wedding reception, and I had so my two friends, they were now going to be my stepsisters, and they were like a little bit older than me, and they were cool, and I wanted to be like them, and I wanted them to accept me, and I wanted them to like me, and I wanted them to think I was cool too. So they were drinking, and so I started drinking. It was a month later. It wasn't even 5 weeks, and I had already forgotten about everything that had happened the first time I drank. And you know, I would love to tell you that it was different and it worked and I was fine, but it just was not the case. I started drinking. I don't even remember picking up the drink. I just know that I did start drinking. I remember they were both of the girls I was trying to impress were shoving rolls down my throat because I was so drunk, and I was gonna get in trouble if they found me like that. And so they were trying to sober me up, and they were giving me all this bread and stuff to soak up the alcohol, right? And the next thing I know, I'm hiding under because the reception was at a hall, and so you've got like a room here, and then you know bathrooms, and then another room over here for a different reception, and so I'm in that bathroom, and I am under the sink in the bathroom, drinking my drink, hiding from them so that they won't try to get me sober. And my aunt, my new aunt, who I just loved her, she had been going through a really rough time. And she came and she tried to take my drink away from me because I really needed to stop and sober up. And she took my drink away from me, and I didn't like that so much. So I bit her so hard that we spent the rest of the evening at the ER. And that's pretty much how my drinking went for the rest of my career. You know, it was, I'm just gonna have one. I black out. I do things to hurt the people around me. I swear I'm never gonna do it again. I get sick and then I start all over again. It didn't change. It never changed. Some people, the progression is slower. Some people, when they pick up a drink, you know, it is casual, and you know, and then it over time it increases, and then they cross this invisible line. That's never been my case. The first time I drank, I was over that line. I never drank normal. Both can be alcoholic, but this is my story. So I drank as much as I could whenever I could, and it was around because my stepdad and my mom loved to drink, and they didn't they figured it was they were of the idea that I'd rather you drink at home than go out there and be in the world and get into trouble or cause chaos. So drinking at home was perfectly acceptable. My mom would have my friend, you know, she'd have let me have my friends over, and she'd go to the store, and we'd send her with a list. You know, I want a pint of this and a pint of that and half pint of this, and she'd go to the store and she'd get it for us, and we'd just have a party at my house. You know, it was a lot of quarter bounce and a lot of chandeliers and a lot of pass out, and you know, just it was just we thought it was fun, but every single time I got sick, got, you know, I blacked out. I did stupid things and regretted it the next day. Well, the regret started to go away a little bit because we just thought it was funny and aha, this is what we do. Because the people I was around were all doing the same stupid stuff. And so, you know, I saw it. You know, I didn't think that there was anything wrong with the way I was drinking because everyone around me drank that way. When I wasn't at my mom's and I was at my dad's, he drank. And so there was this he drank, he was a little different. It wasn't a big party. It was just okay, when you drink in the morning, you mix it with orange juice. And when you drink in the afternoon, you have a couple beers. And then in the evening, we have olives for this, right? And so it was just that's what you do. You just drink. I would open the refrigerator and there'd be, two rows of all these different kinds of olives, that's what you do. I knew how to make a martini perfectly at 3 years old. Nothing wrong with that, right? So I'm that person at school. Everybody wants to come to my house and hang out. By the time I was 16 and driving, I was the girl that in the parking lot that you could get other outside activities from. And I was an entrepreneur, I'll just say that. And so I didn't take classes in school so that I could learn something. I took classes in school so I could be around my customers. So auto shop was popular. Wood shop was popular. These are classes that I was taking in high school. I became that person. The parties that I went to, it would start out innocently enough. We're just gonna listen to people play music in the garage, no problem, and it would turn into a big party, and then pretty soon, there's violence, there's sex, whatever, drugs, all the stuff going on, and this is just normal. We're the cool kids. You want to be like us, right? And that's my attitude that I took toward it. It never occurred to me that other people didn't live like this or didn't want to live like this. So that's just how it went. By the time I was 18, I was out on my own immediately as soon as I graduated high school at 17. And then, by the time I turned 18, my drinking had gotten so bad. When I drank, some people say that when they drink, they break out in handcuffs. When I drank, my clothes would fall off. I don't know. It just happened, right? And so I became very promiscuous, and my friends started telling me that they didn't want to be around me because they were getting a reputation because they were hanging out with me. And slowly people started to leave my life. And so at 18, I went to my first AA meeting. My uncle took me. All I remember, in fact, I didn't remember that I had gone to this meeting until I was probably 2 years sober. I do remember it now that, after that I remembered it, and it was this room full of guys that, I grew up in Detroit, so it was all a bunch of factory workers. And I think there may have been one or two other women in this room full of like 60, 65 guys. I was 18. They were none of them, all of them were old in my mind, because they weren't my age. And, I couldn't understand why I was there or what I was supposed to be doing. I just felt very self-conscious, and I didn't understand what was happening. I didn't understand what AA was, what alcoholism was. It just didn't, and so I never went back. I just didn't understand. And I went back and I thought, well, I'll just quit drinking for, on my own. I don't need any help. I'll just do this on my own. And so for 10 months, I just threw myself into school and work. I had three part-time jobs and I was going to school full time. I literally had no time to drink, no time to think about drinking. And so I just kept myself that busy. And I don't know. I was at my one job where I was a cocktail waitress in a bar, in a bowling alley. It was a bowling alley. And this cute guy comes over and says, "Can I buy you a drink after work?" And I was like, "Sure." let me get off work. And so I turned to my boss and I said, I'm not feeling good, I'm going home. And I sat down with this guy. Literally, she's on one side of me, he's on the other. I sit down with this guy and we proceed to get drunk. And he's carrying me out of the bar because, this is what I do. He's carrying me out of the bowling alley, and my boss walks up and says, if you're gonna go home early sick, at least go to a different bar and get drunk. And I said, you're not gonna have to worry about that anymore because I quit. Within a month of picking up that drink, I quit or lost all three of those jobs, and I dropped out of school. And within 3 months, I lost my place to live and was couch hopping because I could not function. I couldn't not drink and I could not function. I was not someone who could do like my dad did, and he could get drunk all night and then get up and go to work the next day. And it was not a problem. I was not that person. My life fell apart. And I could not function. So, I did have other ways of earning money. So I did that for a little while. That my world became so small. It became so small. And the people in it weren't the kind of people that I wanted to be around, but they were the only ones that would tolerate me. And I just felt so lost, but it was everyone else's fault. It was the school's fault. It was the city's fault. It was my employer's fault. It was my mom's fault. Everybody else was to blame for my predicament. It wasn't because of me. It wasn't because of my drinking. It wasn't because of my attitude. It had nothing to do with my behavior. It was all because the world was out to get me. And, I felt like I was fighting an uphill battle. It wasn't fair. It just isn't fair. And so I had a friend who said, why don't you come with me? And I was like, I need to get out of this place. And she said, okay, come on, let's go to LA. All right. I'd never been to LA, but okay, why not? So we got on a plane. I sold the few things that I had left. And this car that it was the so such an alcoholic car. Like in the back seat, the floorboard was gone. It was like rusted out, and there was like you could see the road as you're driving. And every time you hit a puddle, the car would stall. But I don't know why, but it just did. So I was able to sell that car for enough money to get my plane ticket to LA. So I get to LA and I'm like, this is going to be different. I'm going to start over and it's going to be great. And, I'll go to college and I'll get my degree and I'm going to be that person that I wanted to be. I wanted to be, a professional. I wanted to be someone that was respected and I could look in the mirror and like who I saw. And I thought, well, LA is going to give me that opportunity. And I can just tell you that when it doesn't work, wherever you go, there you are. And nothing changed just because I changed my environment. My circumstances do not determine how I'm going to feel. They don't change how I feel. I feel isolated, alone, uncomfortable in my own skin. Like just something wrong, and I don't know what it is, and I can't figure it out, and I just need to feel better. And that's how I am when I'm not drinking. That they call it a disease, dis-ease. It was just that, oh, that uncomfortable feeling that it just seemed like nothing would make it go away, and I couldn't. And I get to LA and my drinking picked up right where it left off. And nothing changed. I got a job as a bartender, and that didn't put me in a position where I was going to meet the best people. And things just got worse. So, LA certainly is the problem now, and so now I have to leave LA. And so my great idea was so my friend and two of my friends, one of them was, his name was Beaver Bill. So he was my connection. He was my guy. And he's like, we need to get, we need to get sober. We need to get, get off all this stuff and get some help. And so he's like, my mom has a trailer out in Death Valley. We'll go there and, sober up. And I was like, all right, well, we get there. There's no running water, no AC, no nothing. We're in the middle of Death Valley. It's 120 degrees in the desert. And this is where we're at. I was like, this is not going to work. So I just kept going and went to Vegas. I'd never been to Vegas, but why not? Pulled into Vegas and, me and my friend, and I got my cat in the back seat and a carrier and got welcomed by the police. I don't know why she pulled me over. All I know is that I didn't go to jail that day. I should have. I was not sober. I was not, I had, stuff in the car that I shouldn't have. The car wasn't, I didn't own the car, okay? I was I just didn't own the car. Anyway, they got us an emergency call. She said, I'm going to be looking for you. I'm going to be looking for this car. And if I find you, you are going to jail. So I went over to this little motel and we called somebody. No one would pay for, no one would send me money. All I had was $10. No one would send me any money. They said, but they would pay for my room for a week. And they called the hotel and paid for it. That's how trustworthy I was. They weren't going to send me any money. And so I got in touch with somebody else I knew that knew somebody there, and they let me stay in their garage and let me hide the car in their backyard. And this is how I got my start in Vegas, living in somebody's garage. It's 110 degrees outside on a regular basis, and now I'm looking for a job and I don't know anybody, and I got no money, and I didn't know what to do. I ended up thankfully getting a job, waiting tables, and little things started happening. Like I remember, I didn't have enough money to pay for the weekly hotel room for the next week. And I didn't have enough, I didn't have enough hours. I wasn't making enough in tips, and I didn't know how I was going to do it. And I just remember thinking, I don't know what's going to happen. I'm going to end up not being able to pay for this little weekly hotel. And I found, I wiped off the chairs, and I found enough chips to turn in, and it was exactly enough to pay the rent. And so I was able to pay the rent and with my tips buy some food, right? And so because I was trying to do the right thing, I was trying to show up and do the right thing. Anyway, so long story short here, I end up getting in touch with this other friend. We end up both working in this in one of the casinos in HR. I worked in HR. And so I got a job in HR, and I got this friend, Dominique, and we're hanging out, we're going to the bars every night, and it was just what you'd think a 25-year-old girl would be doing in Vegas, it was crazy. It was just party time 100% of the time. And she comes over to me one day and she says, I need to go into rehab. And I was like, what for? And she said, 'cause I'm alcoholic. I said, you're alcoholic? And she goes, yeah. And I said, I can see that. And she goes, so are you. And I was so offended. I was like, what do you mean I'm an alcoholic? And she said, well, everything I do. We're always together. We're always drinking together. We're always, why am I alcoholic and you're not? And I said, because I can handle it. I was so convinced. Like I was in so much denial. I could not see the insanity of what I had just said. She was doing better than me. She had her own apartment. She had, she was doing okay. So she goes into treatment, she comes out, and I'm like, okay, this isn't gonna last long. So I'll just be her friend and I'll go with her to these meetings, and pretty soon we'll be back to our old thing, because she was my transportation. I didn't have a car. I go to meetings with her, and we start. It was the same meeting every day at 8:30. 8:30 at night. It was an hour and a half meeting, and then we'd all go across the street to Arizona Charlie's to a coffee shop where you get like $1.99 steak and eggs, and we'd sit there till 3 in the morning, just talking. All of us AAs talking, and something happened in those week or in that it was like a week or two. I don't even know, but it was like a week or two. We did this pretty much every day. And she called me one day and she was like, I'm not going to the meeting. I drank last night and I was so mad. I was like, after all I did for you, I haven't been drinking so that I could help you. And then you go drink and you don't even call me. I was so mad. And I get off the phone with her and I had what they like to call a moment of clarity where I was standing in my living room and it was as clear to me again as like my first drink. It was I'm standing in my living room and I get a glimpse of myself in the mirror, the picture mirror I had above my couch. And it was like I saw myself for the first time in a long time. I really saw what I looked like and it scared me. It scared me. I was like 84 pounds. My eyes were all sunken in. I looked bad. I looked very unwell. And it scared me. The reason it scared me so badly was because about 6 months earlier, my dad lost his younger sister to alcoholism. And she was kind of like my part-time mom when I was growing up. I spent summers over there, and I knew she had a drinking problem. She was a closet drinker, but I had seen it, and in a very short period of time, I watched her go from, just the typical, 42-year-old woman to she looked like she aged to like 90 in just a matter of a couple of months. It was terrifying to watch. And when I looked in that mirror, and when I was growing up, people used to say we looked alike. And when I looked in that mirror, I saw her, and it scared me, because she died at 42 from alcoholism. She drank herself to death. And I thought, oh my God, I'm gonna die if I don't go to that meeting. And I got on my bike and I rode out to the meeting and turned myself in. I was like, I just need help. I need help. I don't know. I'm an alcoholic and I need help. And I don't know how to do this. I don't know what this is. I just know that when I'm with you guys, I feel safe. When I'm in a meeting, everything else shuts off and my mind is quiet. And this is the only place that has ever happened, except for at the bottom of a bottle. And I just need my mind to be quiet. And you guys know how to do that. And so I threw myself in the middle of AA. I got involved and I got a sponsor and I was going to meetings, as many meetings as I could get to in a day, in a week. I probably went to three meetings a day for the first 6 months because it was the only place my mind would shut up. It was the only time that I felt like I could take a breath. I started working through the steps with a sponsor and I had a true experience with the steps. It was almost like and I believe that the steps are a spiritual path, that if I do one step, it intuitively leads me to the next one, because it's almost like a recipe. It works. It does work. And as soon as I admitted that I was powerless, and the only reason I could do that was because being in the rooms with you guys, I got a little bit of hope. And through seeing, I could relate to what you guys were saying. I could relate to how you felt. I could relate to how you thought. Maybe not everybody's drinking, but there were people in there that talked about drinking the way I drank. And I could relate to that. And you guys were laughing and had this sense of freedom and peace that I didn't have. And that gave me enough hope to go, all right, I'm willing to do this. And I admitted that I had a problem and that it whatever was helping you do it was going to help me. I didn't call it God. I didn't call it, I didn't have a name for it. It wasn't even something I tried to put into words. It was just, I knew you guys were doing something that was working and I wanted to do that. And I trusted that I could have that in my life too. And I did the third step with with my group of people at Arizona Charlie's in that coffee shop. So the whole time we were going to that coffee shop, we were leaving AA pamphlets for our waitress because she was definitely one of us. And that night, and I don't know why this happened, but that night she said, I want to come to a meeting. And they like 20 of us went into a room and we're into like the back area where, I don't know. And we all got on our knees and we said the third step prayer together. And because she needed to do it, I don't know. Maybe she had been in before or whatever. I just know that that's why we did it. And that was how I did my first third step. And it was the first time I thought about someone besides me. I was doing it for her. I wasn't doing it for me. And, I asked this guy, his nickname was Cowboy Tommy. He was the only one that talked slow enough for me to actually hear him. And I said, so now that I've turned my will and my life over to God, what do I do now? I don't, what does that mean? I don't even know who God is. He goes, all you have to do is seek. Just seek. That's all it is. Just seek God. That's what the third step is. Just seek. And I was like, okay. And so I asked my sponsor, I said, what do I need to do next? And she said, oh, next, we launched out on a course of vigorous action. And she had me start my fourth step. And, I was 26 years old. I didn't have a lot of, years behind me. I didn't never got married, never lost a home, all of those things. But I had a lot of resentments. And I didn't know what I was doing. I just know she said, write down all your resentments. And she told me how to do it. And I was like, okay. And so I went through and I wrote all the things she told me to write. And I thought, finally, someone's going to hear my side of the story. I mean, I really did not understand what was happening, which is probably why I was so honest. I didn't have any expectations of what was going to happen when I did this. I just did what I was told because I wanted what you guys had. And it doesn't matter if I understand, oh, you have to do it in this many columns or that many, or, none of that matters. It's my intention. I just was doing what I was told and to the best of my ability. And so I did that. And as I was doing it, it was the first time I had ever looked at anything from another person's point of view. Ever. It had never occurred to me. Like, for the first time in my life, I thought, oh my God, my mom actually had a life before I came into the picture. Like, it never occurred to me. Now, some people, when you're a teenager, that there's some of that, but it was really just mind-blowing to me that, I had never stopped to look at it from another person's perspective. It was always about how it affected me, what was I going to get out of it, and how are you going to make it better? And so I had that just writing the fourth step. And then I did my fifth step with her, and I was so offended. I get to her house, she's like, "Okay, well, come over and we'll do the fifth step." I was terrified. I was just terrified to do this fifth step. And I get there and she's got dinner on the table and her husband's, and I'm like, "What? I can't eat. Are you kidding me?" My stomach's flip-flopping all over the place and whatever. And so I don't know. We had dinner and then we go in this spare bedroom and I tell her my story. Now I'm 26 years old. It probably took 2 hours for me to go through my inventory. And all she did was listen. There was at no point did she interrupt or give her, make it about her or give me guidance or anything. She just listened. And at the end of it, she said, "You're not as bad as you think you are." And she gave me a hug, and I'm very perceptive, and I did not notice her seeing me differently. Like, you can tell when someone has changed their opinion about you, and I didn't see any of that. She just looked at me with as much love as she had before that. And I left there and I thought, wow, I can't believe I did that. And I felt like I was floating. And some people say they have their, it's a cliche. Oh, you had your first spiritual experience. Well, I went home and I was quiet for an hour and I did the has there but I didn't leave anything out. I was all in. I had no expectations. I wasn't trying to win, get anything over on anyone. I just wanted relief. And I got on my knees and I did the seventh step prayer and I had a spiritual experience. It was just this complete different perspective on myself and the world and God. And that's what a spiritual experience is. It's just a shift in attitudes and motives, is what our book says. And that happened to me. I started seeing things from a completely different view. And I found a higher power. And it didn't, it was, I didn't have a name for it. I just knew that it was personal to me, that I was no longer alone. That feeling that I had when I was little, how I always felt different and alone and separate, went away. And I was no longer alone, even when I was alone. And I was on fire for AA. I did my ninth step. Oh my God, that was awful. I was making minimum wage and I owed a whole bunch of money for bad checks that I wrote because back then you could do that. And so my sponsor made me get a roommate so that I could take the money that I did have and pay off these bills. And I couldn't get a checking account because a lot of the places I owed money to were with the bank. So I had these envelopes on this bulletin board and I had how much I owed in each one. And I'd put like $3 in each one each week. And when I had enough money in there, I'd get a money order and send it off. And one day I get this call from my dad. Now he's still back in Michigan. I'm in Vegas, and he says, "Well, it's about dang time." And I was like, "What? What are you talking about?" Like, and he goes, "Every time I went into that grocery store, I'd get a dirty look from the cashier because our name is on the bad checklist." And he's like, "And you finally paid it off because our name is not on that list anymore." And he said, "And I don't have to feel ashamed to walk in that grocery store and go buy my groceries." And I had no idea that any of that was happening. No idea at all. And, here I am just doing what I'm told and, making my financial amends. And I didn't even know that I had harmed my dad in this way. I never did tell him that it was a bad check that I wrote to help celebrate his birthday, but I don't know, never told him that. But I started sponsoring people. I got involved in recovery. I bought a home. I went back to school. I got my degree, and life became perfect. And then, I got married to someone in AA, and there were things going on in that home that I couldn't talk about in AA. I couldn't talk about them, and there was shame. There was confusion. There was fear, and I was afraid to talk to people in recovery about what was happening because I didn't feel like I had someone I could go to that wasn't going to go back to him and say it. And so I didn't feel like AA was a safe place anymore. And I didn't want to lie to my friends. I didn't want to share in meetings because I didn't want to be dishonest about what was happening. And so I slowly withdrew from AA, and things just continued to progress at home, and I ended up picking up a drink. I didn't even think about it. 8 years of sobriety and 8 years of knowing that I'm alcoholic, 8 years of knowing that if I pick up a drink, I could die, 8 years of trying to help other people get sober, sharing in meetings and sponsoring women and this awesome relationship with a higher power. And all of it went away because I started being dishonest about what was going on with me, because I didn't have someone that I could talk to about what was happening. Or at least I didn't think I could. Okay, there's a difference. There's someone you could talk to always, but I didn't think I could. And so, I let myself get separated and ended up picking up a drink. And it took 5 years. And I lost everything. I lost my corner office at the county. I lost, my home. I lost two cars, filed bankruptcy, foreclosure, the whole bit, and moved in with mom, who I hadn't really even spoken with in years. And so here I am driving to Virginia in a U-Haul, towing my car, and coming to live with mom. And I couldn't figure out, how did this happen? What happened? And I get to Richmond, and I wish I could say that, immediately I got sober, but again, my circumstances aren't what keeps me sober. It doesn't matter where I live, there I am. And it took me another year before I was ready. But that last year, I sat in my apartment alone. My phone never rang. There was one person in the world aside from my mother that would talk to me, and she was another drunk woman that I met in my apartment complex walking the dog. And her and I would just drink together nonstop. And I was not employable. I could not function. And the only reason I got sober was because of Michelle. And that was my friend Michelle. She would tell me all the time, you need to go back to AA. You can do it. I know where all the meetings are, because she had tried to get sober, never had more than 30 days. But she, I remember we got in my car. We were drinking, but we got in the car, and she went and showed me where all the meetings were. And she circled them all in her where and when, and said, oh, you got to go talk to this person at this meeting and this person at that meeting. And she knew all the meetings and all the people. And we kept saying, we're going to do this, we're going to do this. And we just never could, because we'd say, well, quit on Monday, and then by Thursday, we should be well enough to be able to go to the meeting. And, Monday night, we were both drunk again. And so, we're sitting there drinking one day, and I look over and I realize she isn't drinking. She hasn't been drinking for days, weeks maybe. But she looked drunk and she acted drunk. And I realized that I was sitting with somebody who had wet brain. And she is my only friend. And I thought it scared me. You know, it was like, oh God. I got up the next day and I went to a meeting. And I remember sitting in the meeting going, I still have alcohol on my breath and I have more recovery than these people. I was so arrogant. Oh my God. But someone in that meeting shared right at towards the end of the meeting, and she talked about God, and she talked about we don't do this ourselves. You know, we trust and rely on our higher power. And it was like, oh yeah, that guy, you know, I was like that. It was like what I needed to hear in that moment. And I walked up to her after the meeting and I asked her if she would help me, and she said yes. And I got pulled back into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I haven't had a drink since, thankfully. I would love to say that was my last date, but I've had many, many surgeries, other things, you know. And I had to get honest about that stuff because if I'm not honest, I'm not going to stay here, right? And I learned that the hard way. So I need to be honest about what I'm doing in my life. And I wasn't honest about, you know, I was trying to change how I felt with other things. And so I got honest about that stuff. And so my sobriety date is 9/1/19. And you know, I've been pulled back in through kindness and love and service of other people. And you know, you know, I struggled in my relationship with God when I came back because I thought, gosh, you know, I did turn my will and my life over to God, and this is what ended up happening. And also, you know, I went between, you know, God lied to me to I'm ashamed, and I took this beautiful gift of recovery and threw it back in God's face, and I don't deserve another chance, you know. And so I went, you know, back and forth and struggled. And someone suggested that I do what our book says. When we got to the third step, and it said, or when we got to the second step, and it says, and we agnostics, we acknowledged our prejudices and we asked ourselves why we had them. And so I went, she had me do an exercise where I went through and I wrote down all my conceptions of God, mine, you know, all of the things that I had that, and what I thought about them. You know, what was my opinion about them? And when I got done with that list, we were able to find a conception of God that I could do business with. Because in the fourth step, it says we're taking an inventory, just like a business. And so I had this new conception of a higher power that it made sense to me. It was something that I could start with, and it has grown and changed, and I hope it continues to grow and change, because I'm changing and I'm growing, and my experience changes my perception of things. And you know, I am in a completely different place in my life today. I am, you know, I have a home, I have a good job. I work with a couple people. You know, I'm blessed to be able to sponsor some people, and you know, I love my home group. But the most important thing in my life is that relationship with my higher power. And every day when I'm, you know, doing my review of my day and looking at my, you know, living this life of self-examination and spiritual principles, I have to make sure that I'm keeping that path clear. That I'm being honest, that I am not fooling myself about the truth, right? And I do that by, you know, going to meetings, sharing in meetings, working with people, talking to my sponsor. You know, we don't just do these things to check off a box, you know, check them off the list. There's a reason why I go to meetings, to put my hand out to someone else. And if I'm so busy up in my head thinking about me that I can't put my hand out to someone else, then I need to go home and do some work and get right with my higher power, get right, talk to my sponsor, what's going on, get some help getting back on track. And when I am, working with another, working with another sponsee or another person, and I'm getting all irritated because they're not doing it right, and whatever, acting like I did when I was coming in. It's like, oh, I'm not spiritually centered. It's just another indication that I've got something going on. I need to go look at it. And so, all of these things give me the opportunity to take another look at where am I at? What am I doing? Am I not being honest? Am I, afraid of something? Am I not, is there something that needs to be adjusted? And if so, do the work to get there. And it's, if I continue to do that and just do what I can to be of service, then that relationship with God is, I feel it. I feel it. I am not alone, it says in A Vision for You that, we know loneliness such as few do. And that is my disease. I am alone, no matter how many people are in the room. And through this program, through this process, through living this new way of life, I don't ever have to be alone again. And it's not because I go to meetings. It's because of all of the things that I do here to maintain my relationship with God. Now I'm not alone. And I get to share that with the people that I go to meetings to see. And it gives me the opportunity to be useful to someone else when I couldn't be useful to my friend Michelle. She passed away 30 days after I got sober. 30 days after I had that experience, she passed away from alcoholism. And I was with her when she said, when the doctors told her that she wasn't going to make it. And she said, but I'm ready now. And I could see the fear in her eyes. And it just, I think about it and I'm like, how many people don't get this opportunity? I'm gonna get up and I'm gonna go to the meeting. Okay, I'm gonna answer the phone. Okay, I'll get on my knees and pray. Okay, I'll do that writing because I don't want to be that person. I don't want to end up going, oh my God, it's too late now. This disease is not, it's fatal. And I don't want my secrets to kill me. And that's exactly what almost happened. So I'm really grateful to be here, and thank you for giving me the chance to share my story. I hope that it helps someone, and I'll pass it back to the chair.